and the court will turn to the next case, case number 09-SC-652, Terry Townsend versus the people. Both counsel ready? Case set for 15 minutes per side. Please keep track of your time and please identify yourself when you start your argument. Thank you.
I'm sorry, is there a warning light?
We should. Is it not working?
Okay.
I hope it is.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Griffin. I'm here on behalf of Terry Townsend today. We're here because Mr. Townsend was convicted of a Class 3 felony escape from ISP for what really should have just been considered a parole violation. Escape, pared down to its basic meaning, is a departure from custody or confinement. The basic meaning of confinement is enclosing someone or something within physical bounds so it or he can't leave. An ISP parolee, under the statute, is deemed to have escaped if he fails to remain within the extended limits on his confinement established under the intensive supervision program. The Court of Appeals has ruled in several cases that ISP parolees are confined to their residence of record during curfew hours. So under that theory, you would escape when you leave your residence of record during curfew. It's my contention that the ISP statute is unconstitutionally vague, but to the extent that it has a discernible meaning, the legislative history suggests that that's what it is, that the residence of record during curfew hours is the closest that you can get to a meaning for confinement in this context. In this case, the jury was instructed such that they didn't have to find a departure from confinement. If you look at instruction 14, which is in the appendix to my opening brief, every single paragraph in that instruction is erroneous. The instruction told the jury, custody or confinement is conduct whereby a person absents himself from the controls placed on him by the state. It's hard to imagine anything broader than that. It also includes the status of an individual who is on ISP. So anyone on ISP is in custody, according to that instruction. It told the jury, the defense had tendered an instruction that said custody or confinement means the extended limits of confinement under the program, but the court changed that to includes. And the effect of that was to accommodate the paragraph that told them that custody or confinement is any controls placed by the state or the status of a person on ISP. So this was a very, very broad instruction of law from the court. It also told the jury that extended limits of confinement include geographic time limits and other established ISP directives placed on the defendant. The defense had tendered an instruction in the statutory language, which is very vague, but at least it was the right statute. The defense instruction would have also told the jury that the prosecution had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Townsend knowingly failed to remain within his established extended limits of confinement under the program. And the court refused to give that instruction in the statutory language.
Wasn't it the defense theory that Mr. Townsend did not have any extended limits at all?
That was part of the defense theory, was that the extended limits had not been established because he was released and he hadn't met with his parole officer. He hadn't been advised of his residence of record, his formal residence of record, and that he could be prosecuted for escape if he left the residence of record. That's right.
So if it's there, if it's the defense opinion, there were no established extended limits, and I guess the prosecution proved that there were established extended limits, then that's what the argument was about, is one, were there such limits, and two, did he leave them, right?
Well, no, this case was very much about whether he had any limits, what they were, and whether he knowingly exceeded them.
Right.
And
maybe I'm misunderstanding you, but I thought that was essentially what I said.
Okay.
Were there limits, and if there were limits, did he leave them?
And did he knowingly leave them?
Yeah, I'm confused also, because this instruction was given, this theory of defense instruction that Justice Rice referred to.
Right.
So that was sent to the jury.
Well, that's right. It was a theory of defense. But the problem is that the court told the jury, okay, the theory of defense is coming from the defendant, so it's not instruction of law. The theory of defense is, oh, I didn't have any established extended limits. But you've got the probation officers on the stand telling the jury, oh, the extended limits of confinement are coming to your appointment and dropping your UAs and all of the other conditions. It's all the conditions. And when the defense is objecting to this testimony, the court's saying, overruled, it encompasses the directives. It includes the directives. And when
your position is the confinement is only the overnight, in this case, the shelter.
I think to the extent that this statute is not unconstitutionally vague, that must be what it means. That is the best that I can
Confinement think. Can't include all the conditions of being out in the community.
It would lose its meaning. It wouldn't mean anything. Escape wouldn't mean anything. Confinement wouldn't mean anything. I mean, if the statute means what the Attorney General wants it to mean, then there's no question that it's facially unconstitutional, because no one would ever know from looking at that statute that if you violate any condition of your parole, you're going to prison for 5 years for a Class 3 felony.
Do you think it's as broad as violating any condition of your parole, or can it be limited more to being where you're?
I think that would still be unconstitutionally vague. I mean, the meaning of escape is a departure from confinement. And when this statute was enacted, it was an expansion of escape, but it was under very certain limited circumstances, and it was not intended to bleed over into other conditions. I think that's pretty clear if you look at the legislative history.
We've sort of wrestled with this problem in a lot of contexts over the years, and I'm sure you're familiar with lots of those cases about what would be confinement for various purposes, when you should get credit. It seems pretty clear that we haven't required that there be a fence around you or a locked door in order for you to be confined in some way. I'm not sure that I'm understanding exactly where the limits are of the test you propose. Is it overnight, being in a house?
The basis for my contention that if the statute has a discernible meaning, it's your curfew at your residence of record, is the legislative history, because I think that's what the drafters of the statute say when Mr. Cherner is saying, well, what does this mean? It could mean anything. It could be any condition. They're saying, no, it's a home detention kind of idea. The DOC representative who helped drafting the statute said, oh, no, we would dock them for any time that they're not at their residence of record. And that's what they're telling the legislature when, at the time the statute's being enacted. And that's also somewhat consistent with the idea of confinement, being confined in a particular place at a particular time. The legislature, it seems very clear, if you look at the legislative history, did not mean to encompass any space-time requirements. I mean, we're all in space and time at all times. So any requirement entails that. Like if you have to go get a UA on Monday afternoon, well, you have to be in a particular place at a particular time. If you have to be at work every day, I mean, virtually every parole condition, regular parole condition, probably encompasses some kind of, you know, space-time component, because that's the world we live in.
I ask you a question about, just tied into this, but about vagueness, so that we, you know, with vagueness, we always have the problems about whether something's facially vague or it would couldn't have any meaning under any circumstances. But here, the argument seems to be with regard to this particular individual, that it's vague as applied to him. But do I understand the contention of the prosecution here, of the people, that if the factual question about whether this defendant really was informed about the limits on him were resolved against him, then what's at issue is whether he did leave the place that he was confined to be, his curfew, whatever.
I think that may be what they're saying, but I don't think it works, because the problem is that in this case, the instructions and the testimony and the arguments were telling the jury to convict him because he missed his parole appointment, and because he didn't establish a residence of record, which, of course, that's what the parole complaint said. His own parole officer said, I'm going to revoke you because you never established a residence of record. I mean, if she didn't think he had a residence of record, I don't know how he was supposed to know that.
Well, he could have gone to his parole appointment. Isn't that kind of a circular argument?
I don't think so.
In other words, you're saying it's just times three kings X until you get to a parole appointment and you get a resident of record?
No.
You can't escape during that period of time?
He clearly violated his parole. He was supposed to go to his parole appointment. He knew he was supposed to go. And that's part of the reason why these instructions are so harmful, is that he went into this trial conceding that up front. And if that becomes an admission of guilt, I don't know why he went to trial in the first place. The parole officer should be advising people of their ISP requirements before they're released from custody. We're talking about a person who's been almost 4 months in jail. He spent about 20 times longer in jail than he did on ISP. He was on ISP for 5 days before he was arrested for drug paraphernalia.
Was he supposed to report to the parole office?
The morning after he was released.
So there's a 4-day differential between when he was supposed to report
I'm referring to his initial release on ISP back in November. He was only on ISP for 5 days, and then he was arrested. And then when he was released after the case was dismissed, or he was acquitted, I don't remember now, one of the two, and so his parole complaint was dismissed, he was not advised at the time of his conditions. He was told, come and see me in the morning. And what I'm saying is, when you're putting somebody under these extra obligations and you're subjecting them to felony liability, and the statute is incredibly vague, people need to be advised at the time. And it's not a free-for-all. It's just a question of telling people what's expected of them at the time.
Well, you know, it's pretty much the expectation is that, you know, the confinement includes the supervision of the parole officer. So I'm really having a hard time, you know, with your argument that puts everything on the parole officer, when he simply could have appeared at 8:30 in the morning for the parole officer, which obviously, you know, the parole officer is supervising the confinement in some way or instrumental in that. I mean, that's the essential requirement, isn't it?
Well, I guess I don't...
And he just took a powder.
You're right. I guess I don't know why every parolee then isn't guilty of a Class 3 felony escape.
Well, isn't it... Don't we have to look at the actual facts? He isn't in the residence that was his pre-existing residence, which was the shelter. He doesn't come to his parole officer. I mean, isn't that a logical conclusion that the jury can look at whether or not he escaped from the supervision, the confinement in the way that the legislature intended confinement to work under this scheme?
I just absolutely don't see it that way. I don't think that's a legislative intent. I think to the extent that there is a discernible meaning to the statute, it is that the ISP entails some component of confinement, and the component of confinement is the component, the condition that resembles custody. It's that you have to go home every night. It's like a work release program. You have to go to jail every night, and that's where you are, and then we know where you are, and you have to be there at a certain time. And this is somewhat consistent with the meaning of confinement, and it allows for a sort of a rational meaning for escape. And without a condition like that, it doesn't make any sense. It's just unconstitutionally vague, and then you've got the whole separation of powers issue, which I don't think I'm even going to get to. But it's a tremendous problem in this case, where the court has no idea what the statute means, and frankly, I don't blame the court. It is very unclear what the statute means, and so the court is permitting the parole officer to tell the jury what it means. And it means something different in every case, because it depends on the conditions. And so the parole officer is holding up the conditions of this man's parole and telling the jury, oh, if he did this, it's an escape. If he missed his UA, it's an escape. And the court is letting the jury asks the court, can you tell us what an escape is? And the court says, oh, I'll tell you at the end. And it lets the jury ask the parole officer. If he had never reported for his initial conditions in November, would he be guilty of escape? Yes. I'm going to save the few seconds I have for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jennifer Berman, registration number 35882, and I represent the people of the respondent in this matter. Petitioner essentially contends that the definitional instructions collectively encourage the jury to convict him for missing a parole appointment, and that missing a parole appointment could never constitute the offense of escape from ISP. This basic premise of his argument is incorrect, and for the following reasons. First, the instructions as a whole properly informed the jury that escape from custody and confinement constitutes the offense, that one's status in ISP constitutes custody and confinement. Custody and confinement includes the extended limits on confinement, and that the extended limits on confinement concern the geographic and time limits established through the ISP directives. Missing a parole appointment can constitute the offense. It is both a geographic and a time limit as a directive. And
could I interrupt you right there?
Of course.
Do you find any problem at all with the definition of extended limits of confinement as including and other established ISP directives placed on the defendant? You've just spoken about time and space limitations, but
right.
What about these other established ISP directives?
I don't. That was my next point, that while geographic and time limits is generally an apt definition of the directives that if you violate, you will commit the offense, I actually think a better way of defining that is that those directives that are geared towards supervising the offender, that are geared towards knowing where the offender is and when they're there, those are the directives that if you violate, you're committing the offense. Because in the context of ISP parole, where you were let out into society, you were allowed to go about your daily activities, the only manner in which you are confined is to the extent that you can be supervised.
And what is the difference, logically or practically, between a parole violation and felony escape?
The distinction is that while certain things will constitute both a mere parole condition and an extended limit on one's confinement, not all parole violations would constitute both. For example, if an offender failed to show up to a UA, that possibly could constitute escape. They're rendering themselves unsupervisable by failing to show up to that appointment. But if they go to the, if they go there and they fail the urinalysis, that cannot constitute escape. That's a directive that's in place merely for determining whether the offender is successful on parole, whether they're really moving towards rehabilitation. It has nothing to do with whether the offender...
Well, you don't think whether an offender is intoxicated or under the influence of other substances affects the ability to supervise the offender?
Well, it might affect their willingness to comply with those conditions that entail supervision. But I don't think it has to do with whether the offender can be found in order to be monitored. Whether the parole officer is able to determine offender is here, where offender is supposed to be at this time, and therefore has not escaped. Because here, you have to replace the prison walls with supervision. That's how the offender is confined. And whether they fail or succeed towards rehabilitation isn't a matter of whether they're trying to abscond from supervision. So that would be my answer to that.
I don't think it's difficult to discern what conditions or directives have this, I guess, space-time sort of notion or supervision sort of notion, and which do not. No, this is all very clear.
I believe it's clear, yes. I believe that if the...
So give me another example.
Okay. If you have a sex offender who's on ISP, and the sex offender goes to therapy, as is required, and doesn't admit to his or her offense, that is not an extended limit on confinement. They've done what they need to do to be where they need to be. They're at the therapy session.
And again, your reason would be because it doesn't render them unsupervisable, I think is the terminology that you chose?
Yes, that may be a made-up word, but yes.
I don't care if it's made up. What I care about is whether, if that's right, can we always tell which directives relate to whether they can be supervised and which do not?
I think we can. And
so if they're unwilling to do, if they're willing to show up, but not willing to admit, and therefore engage in treatment,
then they can be supervised. They violated their probation, perhaps.
But so they can be supervised, even though you got a sex offender who is not willing to address the issue, they can be adequately supervised.
Correct. And I think that's similar to escape from a correctional facility.
I would have thought the only question here is, where are you? You know?
Where are you, and are you
where
you need to be?
Or have you told them where you are?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that what it comes down to?
I believe that's essentially what it comes down to, but I think that there are examples outside of that. And one that I thought of is that if you are, if you have an ankle bracelet for electronic monitoring, and you remove that ankle bracelet, but you remain in your residence of record, and you change your phone number, and all of these things so that they can't actually access you, they can't find you, they don't know where you are. But you're still located in your residence of record. I mean, you haven't necessarily violated the geographic limits of your...
But you're saying that's escape. What you just described as
escape, yes. Yeah.
What's the notice, Ms. Berman, that should be given by the to the defendant so that he or she may know what constitutes escape?
I think the notice that was given here is perfectly sufficient. And again, the notice is given at the point that you're released from prison and sent out into the program. And that notice is that here are your extended limits on confinement. Here are the things that you have to do. If you violate them, you can be held liable for escape.
Maybe I misunderstand the facts, but I thought that he was advised, as you were saying, at the initial release.
Correct.
Then he was not fully advised at the revocation, after the revocation was dismissed later. Is that correct?
He was not quite. He was fully advised in November when he was released from prison into ISP. And 5 days later or so, he was a complaint was filed, and he was put in jail for a probation violation that also constituted another offense.
Dismissed.
That was dismissed.
So then the second time, that's what I'm after.
Right. And they had a hearing at which they had a parole hearing where they said, we're not going to revoke your ISP parole. It's still in place. Do you understand the conditions of your ISP parole? Do you understand the extended limits, I believe? And the offender said yes.
I think I understand your argument. I'm really trying to get the principle behind it.
Okay.
But I understand your argument is basically that it kind of goes back to the first advisement.
Correct.
But that's not really my point. point is, what should that person be told at the time they're released specifically in order to be liable for the consecutive escape sentence? As opposed to just revocation of parole.
Right. I think if you tell them that if you violate the geographic limits of your confinement, if you violate time limits of your confinement, that's going to pretty much cover it.
Includes,
if you tell them that if you...
Wait a minute, and what does that specifically include for every parolee?
That's going to include your curfew directive. It's going to include missing an appointment with your parole officer, because that is somewhere you have to be, a specific time you have to be there, and it's obviously geared towards supervision and keeping track of where you are.
So in other words, what you're going to say is practically, what we would be saying, that if for every defendant that misses an ISP parole date, which happens, I think, very frequently in the real world, that constitutes a consecutive felony escape?
It could constitute it. I think you have to...
And it's up to the discretion. That's right. It would be up to the discretion. Excuse me for a minute.
Okay.
Up to the discretion of the parole officer, right? And so basically we have a very serious crime totally being determined by the whim or the arbitrariness of the parole officer, whether I like you or not, whether I want to revoke you or not, or whether I want to file a criminal escape. Now, that does not seem to be the way our criminal law should be set up.
No, but I don't believe that is. I think that there's enough guidance given to the parole officers.
What would the guidance be if technically every missed appointment is a felony escape?
But it's the circumstances as a whole, whether your entire conduct has rendered you unable to be supervised. So if you miss the parole appointment, but you're at your residence of record and call your parole officer and say, I'll come in at another time, you haven't absconded, you haven't escaped. You have to look at the entirety of the conduct, which is what they did here at trial. They prosecuted him for the combination of conduct, missing the parole appointment, failing to reside at his residence of record, and that itself collectively constitute the offense of escape. He made it so that they could not find him. He could not be supervised, and it was the equivalent of scaling the prison walls.
And do I understand then, as to make the last step, despite some of the language Justice Marcus cited, you believe that the jury was adequately informed so that they could apply these distinctions that you're making between what's a parole violation and what was an escape?
Absolutely. They were informed that custody and confinement includes extended limits, and that the extended limits concern geographic and time limits. The only conduct put before them was missing the parole appointment and combined with failing to reside at the residence of record. And the jury could have determined from that it constituted the offense. Defense counsel didn't even contest that conduct occurred. The defense simply contested, I was never on ISP at the time because when I was released from jail, I was never reinstated into the program. And the facts showed that he didn't have to be reinstated because it was never terminated.
You phrase that as they could have determined from that. And I guess the question is the flip side. And I want to make sure you answer that the same way, is that is there was no likelihood that they would have determined he was guilty of an escape for some other reason.
Absolutely not. There was no other conduct presented to them that did not constitute failure to remain within the extended limits on confinement. If there are no more questions, I would ask that you affirm the Court of Appeals decision. Thank you.
I want to go right to Justice Coates' question. The other conduct is his failure to establish a residence of record. That was in evidence, and in fact, they asked the probation officer if he hadn't reported to his first appointment and established his residence, would he be guilty of escape, and she said that he would. I just want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. One is this statute did not prescribe standards sufficiently definite to circumscribe the official's
authority. Sorry, Ms. I think your time is up.
Oh, I apologize. I would ask you to reverse. Thank you.
Thank you both for your argument. Case to be submitted on the briefs. We'll be in recess until 1:30.